Today, I would like to discuss some situations where the topological theories, which have been introduced in some of the lectures and will be the topic of most of the lectures, interact with things that are not topological, but they are holomorphic. Now, it's worth saying immediately that a lot of the even though all of these theories are topological, a lot of the calculations are done using algebraic geometry, both in not just in the target space of these theories, but also in the space-time itself. And that already might look a little bit weird to you, because if you're trying to do something topological, why should I put complex structure on things? And already there, you could say that a lot of the calculations secretly are inherited from an holomorphic setup, which has been deformed to something topological. But today, I would like to discuss situations where, although the theory of studying has been deformed to something topological, some defects, some subspaces of your manifold, there might be something left which is still topological. So the typical example would be I'm studying a three-dimensional theory, which is topological, but along it has a bound, it may meet a boundary condition, which requires a complex structure, and such that the local operators that live on the boundary are not topological, but they depend holomorphically on the position along the boundary. So the topological defects are sort of thought of in a categorical perspective, typically. So if you have a topological field theory, right, say in three dimensions, you can define typically topological defects of various dimensionality in it. These defects are sort of modifications of your theory along a manifold of some codimension. And in a topological setup, they tend to give you categorical structures because the different defects can be, pretty much because being topological allows you to do composed things. I can take local operators and bring them together and compose them, or I can take lines and fuse them. I can take surfaces and fuse them. So you end up, and if I say I have a line and I have two different lines, there will be a space of local operators that live between the lines. And these spaces of local operators can be composed. So you end up with categories. So you typically have, you know, a category of lines, a true category of surfaces and whatnot. And a lot of this has been introduced in some of the lectures, or will be introduced or discussed in other lectures. From a quantum field theory perspective, all of this categorical stuff has distilled information from what is the more natural perspective, which is that of factorization algebras, so, which I don't pretend to understand. But my assumption is typically when I say the word factorization algebra, it means whatever properties do all of operators on local things have in quantum field theory. So factorization algebras that are topological can be distilled in this sort of categorical perspectives, you know. And you can have more general situations where things are not topological, and then you perhaps what is the mathematical structure which distills factorization algebras which are not topological might be less obvious or less well studied. Now, if I just have a two-dimensional surface in my space-time, in my topological field theory, which is holomorphic, let me call it an holomorphic defect theory, then the structure of local operators that live on that surface is reasonably well understood. So I have my operators, they tend to depend, they will depend holomorphically on the position up to BRST exact things. If I forget for a moment all the derived things, then I'll have what's called the chiral algebra or vertex operator algebra. I have a situation, I have some space of local operators, and I have some operations on this space, which encode the physical procedure of taking two operators close to each other. Something like this. You know, I take an operator, I place it at Z, I take another operator, I place it at zero, and as Z approaches zero, I will find some singularities. And the coefficients of these singularities, or of the coefficients of this whole power series expansion, will be new operators, will be other operators inside my space of local operators. This sort of thing satisfies some axioms, which make sure that bringing operators together in a different order is consistent. And we could discuss, now I don't know how much the notion of vertex operator algebra or chiral algebra is familiar to you. But before I continue, I would like to have a poll. How many people have heard of vertex algebras and chiral algebras? Okay. How many have used one? Okay, that's not bad. Now, in the sort of setup we're discussing, presumably one needs some derived version of this. Although I have to say, I still have to find a situation where I actually need to use a derived version of vertex algebras or chiral algebras. For some reason, the cohomology, you know, the cohomology tends to be all in degree zero, and but I don't know why this is happening. But in practice, I will just talk about vertex algebras, understanding that there is some derived stuff, but I don't actually see it in the algebra itself. It will become important for other aspects. Another example of something that could happen is I could have a three-dimensional locus where I put a defect and where there is some holomorphic topological defect. And now I have operators which, you know, I have a space with coordinates t, z, z bar, and my operators only depend on z. Effectively. And this is the sort of things, you know, if this was a theory, this is the sort of things that was discussed by Kevin in his first lecture. And how to distill an holomorphic topological factorization algebra in three dimensions is something I'm not sure about. I don't know if that's, you know, the full axiomatization has been written down. Intuitively, something which might be useful perspective is that if I look at vertex algebras, what I'm doing essentially, I'm taking the complex plane and replacing the complex plane with C star. And I'm saying every operator in two dimensions can be integrated along the circle to get sort of an operator in an effective one-dimensional theory, where which is like quantum mechanics. And then I can also put take a cigar and play Superettos at the tip to get. So every operetto sort of can play a dual role. They can be placed in an integrated form, or they can be placed at the tip. And I get an algebra with a module and certain constraints which tell me that essentially I can take an operator away from the tip. This is what a vertex algebra is. A vertex algebra is, you know, a vacuum module whose elements can be promoted to families of operators acting on the vacuum module in a specific way. And I assume you can do the same for an homomorphic topological theory. You could take the theory on a cigar times R, and that would look like a two-dimensional thing. And now taking, you know, integrating operators along your cigar might give you some kind of an L infinity algebra of local operators, and also an A infinity module for that. Anyway, this is not something I want to discuss today. I just want to say, you know, here and there I'm going to put invitational things. Things that as a physicist I would love to see. I would love to see the higher categorical version of vertex algebra, which controls holomorphic topological twists. So presumably, it might be a situation where I have an infinity algebra, which plays the role of a vacuum module, and some functor to an L infinite, you know, a collection of functors to the center of the A infinity algebra. But I don't know if the axiomatics have been written down or can be written down for some nice examples. Now, what is the interplay between these holomorphic structures and the topological field theory that this lives in? I mean, you could ask, how do I even know that somehow these operators that live on this two-dimensional space are part of a greater structure? And if I just give a vertex algebra, how would I know if it can be the vertex, if it can represent local operators of a 2D theory or of a defect in a 3D theory or a defect in a 4D theory? Now, something that you can do in a setup like this is to say, okay, let me sort of specialize to 3D in 2D for now. So, as I said, the simple setup is that I have a three-dimensional theory, and a two-dimensional holomorphic boundary condition. Now, there are local operators that live at points in your boundary, which are holomorphic and belong to some vertex algebra, some chiral algebra. Something I can do is to take a topological defect, like a line in the topological field theory, and have it end at the boundary. The moment I do that, I need to talk about the space of local operators that can live at this endpoint. Give it a different name. These local operators will still have an holomorphic dependence on the location of the point. And they will live in some space, which depends on the choice of line. And what I can do is I can take local operators that live in the bulk, that live away from the defect, from the line endpoint, and bring it to the endpoint. So this will make this space into a module for the vertex algebra module for the algebra associated to the boundary. So you get sort of a functor from the lines in the bulk to the modules per testare la modules for the boundary Karl algebra. And what distinguishes local operators here from local operators that don't have a line? Well, these operators are local, truly local, meaning if I bring one of them for a walk on the plane and until it goes back to the original location, nothing can change because correlation functions of local operators only depend on their positions, nothing else. And so these operators must be truly local with each other. On the other hand, these ones end with these endpoints. On the other hand, two endpoints don't need to be local to each other because if I bring it around, the lines will get tangled. So these operators, as I said, don't form a vertex algebra, they form modules for the vertex algebra of the A. And the way this, if you try to braid sort of the mover points around each other, which is a well-defined notion in the world of vertex algebras potentially, their braiding must be captured by the behavior of the lines. But here it will be a functor of braided. There is a bit of a Riemann-Hilbert problem going on here. So here I have the lines which form some kind of a braided category. And then there are the chiral modules for the chiral algebra, which form some kind of a chiral category, typically. So that you can write down some differential equations that perhaps control the way one of these endpoints goes around the other. And the relation between the two is kind of a Riemann-Hilbert correspondence. Let me discuss another example of the relationship. I could take the two-dimensional space to be a Riemann surface instead of the plane. Now, if I try to put to compute correlation functions of operators of chiral algebra on a Riemann surface, if I had to sort of solve the word identities that come from the OPEs, I will get a space of solutions called the chiral cohomology. And this chiral cohomology represents sort of local solutions to the problem of putting operators on the Riemann surface. If you try to start deforming the Riemann surface and moving around the mapping class group on the Riemann surface, you will not go back to the same solution. So these space of conformal blocks will have a non-trivial action on the mapping class group and things like that. Or I don't know, if I had lines ending, and if I put elements of modules, I will have interesting behavior as I braid these points around the surface. The three-dimensional topological field theory placed on a surface times time has a space of states, which you could denote as Z, Zt on sigma. If you give me a state, this is a well-defined physical calculation. There should not be any ambiguity on the solution. So, so just taking this picture and computing gives me a very specific, once I provide a state, must give me a very specific correlation function of operators in the chiral algebra on the Riemann surface. So again, I get a map between these vector spaces, and this map must commute it mapping class group action, etc. And again, it's a bit of Dilma Hibbert situation, because the way these conformal blocks changes at the form the Riemann surface is controlled by some differential equations. On the other hand, on the left-hand side, the way the space of states evolve as I evolve space, it's a local system. Which is the monodromy of the differential equation we define on the other side. So, so I think it's fair to say that typically when you have this sort of holomorphic defects inside the topological field theory, they give you a Riemann-Hilbert perspective on the properties of this topological field theory. They give you holomorphic quantities, like, an holomorphic connection on the bundle, which compute the topological properties of the TFT, like a local system. Now, in a lot of situations, these arrows go both ways. But again, it's not quite clear to me to which degree this is a universal phenomenon. It should be possible to find situations where this is not the case. I'm not saying it very well. A better way to say it is that there seem to be, in a lot of examples, there seem to be sort of a universal topological field theory through which these maps factor through. So there seems to be some universal topological field theory whose space of states is the space, the chiral homology, and such that then this map factors as an interface, a map between topological field theories. And the same for the categories. Now, I will discuss sort of a very physical example of sort of rational conformal field theory, where it's definitely true that the chiral cohomology, the modulus, the space of the category of modules define a topological field theory. But it is not clear to me to which degree this happens universally. When I look at pretty general vertex algebras, the category of modules can be terrifying. And actually, when I write an arrow like this, or I will try to say that this might be the same as this, the real question is, which kind of modules should I look at to have a hope that they might be the lines of some associated topological field theory? Which kind of conformal blocks should I look at that can have hope to be states of a theory? And I will discuss now sort of the A model and B model versions of these pictures. And even in those situations, these questions are just at their infancy, I think it's fair to say. And I think are interesting questions. Now, what do I do in the A model or in the 3D A or B models to get pictures like this? Well, Justin kindly provided the answer on the blackboard. which might be readable to some of you after the lectures you attended. They're almost readable by me too at times, but not always. So I will try to tell you the physics perspective on this expressions, but it's just to say that in the B or A twists of a three-dimensional gauge theory, there are natural boundary conditions which turn out to be holomorphic instead of being topological. And these formulae are trying to describe the Lagrangians, which in the shifted symplectic world would describe these boundary conditions. Okay, and perhaps I'll try to say some physics words, and then we can go back to this formula and see if I can translate. So, want to take some theory labeled by gauge group G and by some matter representation R, which is often the star of something else. So it doesn't have to be. And then, if you remember, morally speaking, this kind of theory is trying to describe to you sort of R simplet quotient by G, morally speaking. Now, on the A side, the claim is that there exists a boundary condition such that the chiral algebra that lives on the boundary is a gauge beta gamma system. So I could write an action which sort of describes this beta gamma system, this gauge beta gamma system to some degree. I will say a bit better, a bit more about that. But basically, it's an action for some fields that live in R, energy connection, anthropomorphic connection. And the action is just uses a symplectic pairing on this representation. And it looks like this. Sorry. Sorry, these are R tensor with k to the 1/2. So you take the bar of one of them and you contract with itself, you get something which is now a 1/1 form, and you integrate it over sigma. So, right, I would have said something like maps from sigma to R mod G.
Do you mean surplus reduction, or do you mean really more?
Sorry? Yes. Yes. So, in practice, what the chiral algebra looks like is the following. You have these fields which have a very simple OPE, which involves the symplectic form. And you have, once you gauge fixed and you do your Beresti formalism and whatnot, you're left with some ghosts that are which live in the Lie-algebra. And it's dual. These are fermions, these are bosons. And there is a Beresti charge. With a schematic form. And basically, the chiral algebra is pretty much polynomials in these fields, although you throw away the zero mod of C, taking cohomology of this Beresti charge. And the I would call it gauge symplectic boson, so gauge beta gamma system. And this appears at the boundary, at a very specific boundary condition for the three-dimensional A model. This is not the only boundary condition that gives, which is holomorphic, presumably. I do not know the full set of holomorphic boundary conditions for three-dimensional A model. You could start from this vertex algebra and do things to it, which presumably will give you something that can still live on some boundary of the 3D model. I would love to have some control on which vertex algebras can live at the boundary of the 3D model. Now for the D model, you get a WCW chiral algebra. There is a boundary condition which supports a WCW chiral algebra with some very specific level. For a funny group, I call it calligraphic G. I hope it's clear, it's not the Lie algebra. The Lie algebra associated to this group is sort of the original Lie algebra plus its dual plus a fermionic copy of the representation. Now, you might ask, what is a WCW model? I think a mathematical answer is that the vacuum module is a Dalbok homology of the affine Grassmannian for this funny group, valid in a certain line bundle. Though this definition doesn't make quite obvious the vertex algebra structure. I would, again, love to have both a better definition and a calculation of this for some examples. I will discuss that perhaps a bit later. In the rest of the lectures, we will often talk about three-dimensional mirror symmetry, which is the statement that there are often pairs of theories such that the A twist of one is the same as the B twist of the other. Now, each of those theories might come with these canonical holomorphic boundary conditions. There is no reason for them to be mirror as well. Although in a billion examples, it does seem to happen. Even if these theories happen to be mirror, the chiral algebras might be different. The statement should be that the topological data associated to this vertex algebra should be the same. Now, a lot of the lectures will introduce things like, our current attempts to describe the category of lines, for example, or the space of states, or these A and B twists. I don't think it's understood perfectly well how to match those to specific modules for these chiral algebras, and to match their braiding and monoidal structures, and so on and so forth. So this is an example of it. And you might wonder, I do not know at this point which side is easier to compute. So I don't know if this should be thought of as a way to learn about these chiral algebras by using the A and B model, or to learn about the A and B model by using the chiral algebras. In more familiar situations, like such as three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory and unitary WCW models, I think information has flown both ways historically. Are there any questions?
So about the Wesimino Witten, should I think of that as like a current algebra for G, but then I take like an extension of it?
Yes. So, sorry, I should have written something. That's true. So, we would expect inside of here to find Kac-Moody currents for this super Lie algebra. So, some standard Kac-Moody currents for G, some auxiliary ones for G dual, and some fermionic ones. Which name to give them for the associated to the matter. And so if this was Kac-Moody instead of WCW, everything would be just generated from those. That would more or less, well, this is a bit like quantizing Pistarro de Tasmanian and so this would be sort of using a different polarization to get Kac-Moody. Anyway, I shouldn't say anything wrong, so I will not say. But when you look at WCW, typically you might lose something and gain something. So in the case where you just had the group itself, the Lie algebra itself, and not this extension, then the WCW model would throw away a whole bunch of null vectors. And if the group is not simply connected, it would also extend the resulting vertex algebra. I assume something similar will happen in this situation, but I do not know almost anything about the details. But right, I think it. It's reasonable to think that this would be a derived extension of the Kac-Moody algebra. Okay. So I want to spend a few more words on, how could these holomorphic boundary conditions emerge? Well, as I mentioned before, both the A model and the B model are expected to be deformations of an holomorphic topological twist. So the holomorphically twisted theory. So in Kevin's lecture, you saw how to def how to do the holomorphic twist of a trilineal two theory. Trilineal four theories have more supersymmetry. When you do the holomorphic twist, you end up with a twisted theory, which still has some residual supersymmetry in a sense, and can be twisted farther to go to the A and B model. If the language makes sense to you, you could say that this theory has two more Cartan elements, which can be added to your to the theory to deform it to the topological twists. We call them eta A and eta B. Now, when you deform a theory, you might or not be able to deform the boundary conditions of the theory to go along with it. Typically, there is an obstruction. You may or not be able to trivialize the obstruction. Schematically, you take eta as restricted to the boundary, and this would obstruct the deformation. And you can deform it if you can find if you can write this as something Q exact infinitesimally, or perhaps something that solves a more Cartan equation with a curve. For a finite deformation. So every boundary condition for the Lomofi topological theory. So first of all, right, when I talk about the boundary condition for Lomofi topological theory, I mean that I'm essentially studying the theory on C times R plus. Now, so every boundary condition for this theory is holomorphic as well, naturally, because it lives on C times the origin. Very few can be deformed. When I turn on the deformation, the boundary condition might also become topological, but might also remain holomorphic. So in Lev's talk, we heard about the two categories of topological boundary conditions for the B-twisted theory. All of those boundary conditions came originally from boundary conditions in the physical theory, which preserved a certain half of the eight supercharges. In physics language, I could say that they were Chukumachu boundary conditions for the four-dimensional theory. And all of the Chukumachu boundary conditions sort of get A-twisted or B-twisted as you turn on these deformations, and they give you topological boundary conditions. Now, it's also possible to consider boundary conditions which preserve a different half of the supercharges, which I'll call 0,4 in physics language. Those do have an obstruction, and only in very few cases this obstruction can be eliminated, as far as I know. And the two examples I know give rise to the boundary to the chiral algebras I described in the previous blackboard. So pretty much, if you give Neumann boundary conditions to all the bosons, you can deform the boundary. So if you use Neumann boundary conditions for all the bosonic fields, you can deform it to the B field, to the B twist, sorry, to the A twist, and it gives you the beta gamma system. And for the B twist, pretty much Dirichlet boundary conditions for all the fields is deformable. And it gives the WZW boundary condition. Now, depending on the amount of time I have, I will discuss more these three-dimensional examples, but first, before that, for completeness, I would like to discuss also the case of four-dimensional topological field theories and holomorphic topological theories. But before I do that, any more questions about the three-dimensional setup? So, let me take now the four-dimensional A-twisted the A-twist of four-dimensional unical four square meals. I didn't catch every part of all the lectures until now. Did you guys see any definition? No. Okay. So what can I say about the A-twist? Four-dimensional A-twist. So it's a twist of this unical four square meals gauge theory. It's labeled just by a choice of reductive group. It has one of the properties it has is that it has topological boundary conditions, which are very similar to the A-twist of 3D unical four theories. So the physical theory has 16 supercharges, It has half EPS boundary conditions, which preserve 8 superchargers, 3DN equals 4. And when you do the A twist of the 4D theory, you automatically do the A twist of a certain class of 3D boundary conditions, and so on and so forth. So you get a some kind of a three category of boundary conditions, presumably. And so on and so forth. And this plays an important role in geometric Langlands. And perhaps we will now see some interesting manifestation of that relationship. Now, what the property that I care about today of this four-dimensional theory is that it admits a boundary condition, which is holomorphic topological. Besides those topological boundary conditions. And indeed, much as in the case of the beta gamma system, you can describe the what happens at this boundary by an action. I should say more about that, and I will. And the action is pretty much the action for BF theory that Kevin discussed at the very beginning of the lectures. Now, this can be a bit confusing because now we've got BF theory in two different situations, the same holomorphic BF theory. Right, we got it from 3DN equals 2. Your gauge, we twisted it and landed on holomorphic BF theory. Holomorphic topological BF theory. But another thing we can do, I can start from 4D and equal 4 with a 3D and equal 4 boundary condition. And I'm claiming that the twist of this will give you this at the boundary. Now, these statements are not actually independent. They are related in a sort of amusing way that you can take the three-dimensional n equal 4 theory on a slab with two different types of boundary conditions. Let me call them Neumann and Neumann prime, such that this is literally that, meaning there was discussion from Kevin of how you can take a theory with two boundaries and get a theory in one lower dimension. Exercise for tomorrow. You can write down the A twist. So after you twist this, here you get the holomorphic topological non-boundary conditions that support BF theory. And here you get a topological non-boundary condition. And so you see that pretty much the only place in this whole picture where interesting local operators happen is at this boundary, because everything else is topological. And so if you just care about local operators and perturbative stuff, you will only notice this BF theory leading on this boundary. And so this is very sensible, that the twist of this picture, to say that the twist of this picture gives you BF theory. You can then ask yourself, what's the role of all this other topological stuff? No, and I'll get to that. But for now, I just want to say this. I have these local operators. They live in this holomorphic, on the holomorphic topological boundary, whose properties are controlled by the word identities of this holomorphic topological BF theory. What can I say about these local operators? Well, sort of the most basic ones are going to look at like trace of B to the N. Uh, Some of the topological theory is very mild in a sense, because if you try to bring operators together, you can always sort of displace them harmlessly in the topological direction. So you don't get OPEs. You get higher operations, in principle. But I think the higher operations are also trivial for these guys. They're like really pretty central, pretty much because they can. No. But anyway, so they can play the role of sort of Hamiltonians in a certain sense that I can try to make more precise, in the sense that when you quantize these operators, so what's the phase space on this theory? Phase space is the cotangent bundle to the space of bundles. If I take this theory on, you know, the classical answer associated to a surface is T star of bundles on the surface. Natural quantization of this system is to sort of try to take functions on your bundle with the fiber directions behaving as differential operators on these coordinates. So B sort of becomes, when you quantize it, wants to become del over del AZ bar. So you get pretty much twisted differential operators on the space of bundles. And if you follow the definition carefully, you end up with what's called the Hitchin Hamiltonians. The quantization of Hitchin Hamiltonians. If you know what that means, that's good. If not, it's not something I can explain in this lecture, but it's not going to be super important. Just to say there is a bunch of differential operators that act in the space of bundle and happens to commute. And it's a beautiful and powerful fact. And here it sort of follows just on the fact that these local operators can be just brought across each other harmlessly because they are different points. Something else fun is that this four-dimensional theory has interesting lines. Now, instead of trying to describe to you the lines in the four-dimensional theory, which you don't know, I'm going to, follow Kevin's presentation. Kevin was discussing local operators in the BF theory. Right? He was saying, to get local operators, we quantize the phase space on a small sphere around the operator. So the space of local operators had to do with the quantization of T star or the fine Grassmannian of G. Modulo G of K for local operators in the bulk. You can add boundaries to the boundary later. In the context of the three-dimensional inequality theory, this is supposed to have some answer because we have some physical theory, has some local operators, we twist it. We must get a specific answer. So there must be some very specific way to quantize this space and get the space of local operators, this phase space, and get some local operators out of them. But it turns out that when you consider these kind of features, where you have a topological thing going out of your holomorph, of your boundary, you're sort of thinking about all possible ways to quantize things at the same time. And I'll say more about that. But in a sense, the line that might end up attached to a local operator, it carries a recipe to quantize things. So essentially, when you try to quantize a cotangent bundle of something, you essentially get D modules on that something. So these lines have informations about the modules on the affine Grassmannian, equivalent D modules on the fine Grassmannian. I'm not gonna try to make this precise, but just to say, there is some category of lines in this Fourier theory. People study it. It plays a role in the right tracker, for reasons I'll mention momentarily. When these lines end on these homomorphic topological boundaries, there must be some local, some space of local operators. Okay. And if I have a local operator, I can start doing things to it. I can take derivatives of it. I can smash trace of b to the n on it. These local operators have no singular OPEs. There is a form of ring. And there are relations between these derivatives. And I want to say it properly. So the local operators and the endpoints of lines must give you some structure, some kind of holomorphic topological factorization algebra and modules for this holomorphic topological factorization algebra, whose properties must be derivable by thinking about the affine equivariant affine Grassmannian. If you think about a variety of things or tools that you use in geometric Langlands on the A side, you can find them a place in this picture. You know, the modules in the affine Grassmannian, and the properties. Now, so in particular, again, if the name Hecke operators ring a bell to you, the endpoints of these line defects are Hecke operators, and are things that act on or Hecke correspondences, are things that act on things on structures on Banji. And you get statements like Hecke operators commute with each Hamiltonians, or Hecke operators satisfy certain differential equations, or Hecke operators fuse in a certain, compose in a certain way, just by staring at this picture hard enough. And as everything is pretty much perturbative here, I assume that just by applying the definitions that Justin and other lecturers have given you to pictures like this, you should be able to derive whole bunch of stuff about Hecke operators, Hecke Hamiltonians, and whatnot. Now, one of the remarkable properties of this A-twisted Fourier theory is that it is the same as a B-twisted theory for the Langlands dual group. So this four-dimensional theory has another twist called the B-twist. And if you do the B-twisted theory for the Langlands dual group, you get the same as the A-twisted theory for the group. But the concrete manifestation of all of these structures will be dramatically different. Here we had this holomorphic BF theory. We had these defects associated to Hecke modifications. Here, we have what's something called an Hopper boundary condition, which essentially tells you that. So the four-dimensional theory is a theory of a connection, of flat connections, and the boundary condition is telling you, Well, write your boundary as, say, R times some surface. Your flat connection brought to the boundary must be an upper on the surface. Covariantly constant upper on the surface. Now you might ask, what is an upper? For curiosity, who knows what's an upper? Not very many people know what an upper. So let me give an example for a very specific for the group SU2, SL2. Okay? So
David, is there a local way to say upper?
Yes. So I have a connection. Let me just first do it on a surface on sigma. I have some connection, the Z bar, which commute, flat connection, flat SL2 connection on surface. An upper is a connection together with a section, an holomorphic section, with a property that S and the ZS are linearly independent everywhere. That's an upper. If you want to do the upper boundary condition in the B model, we're going to add a derivative respect of time, which has to commute with everything. So S is a section of your bundle tensor with k to the minus 1/2. So that this equation makes sense. Now this boundary condition requires is an homomorphic boundary condition simply because it's using the splitting into Z and Z bar on sigma. What could be the local operators at such a boundary condition? Well, the space of uppers is a subspace of the space of flat connections. The space of flat connections has if you write the space of flat connections, if you think about flat connections as bundles of holomorphic connections, it doesn't really have many holomorphic functions in it. Because, you know, it's not easy to get something gauge invariant out of a holomorphic connection. But the space of uppers has a lot of holomorphic functions on it. Essentially, you can take the second derivative of S. You can convince yourself that it must be multiple of S. And this multiple is what's called a classical stress tensor. It's a section of a bundle on sigma, which is a shifted version of the symmetric square of the of K. Anyway, it's something that can be expanded out. There, you know, there is a finite dimensional space of these. But anyway, so T, you can think about T itself. The value of T itself is a local operator. And of course, derivatives of T and T del T or whatever, you know, polynomials in PNAs, derivatives are all nice local operators that live at the boundary. And if you want to match it to the dual picture, well, the dual picture, if I think this actually could be SO3. Let me call it the true. Sorry. Anyway, on the dual side, you essentially have trace of B squared, trace of B cubed, you know, for SL2, trace of B cubed, and all the others can be rewritten as polynomials in trace of B squared. And trace of B squared matches T under this is duality. And I could say a lot of fun things about how T transforms as I change coordinates. You know, B is a one form, naively, so trace of B squared would be a true form. On the other hand, if you look at how T transforms as a true form plus a shift. So if you change coordinates, it changes by something called the Schwarzian derivative. On the old coordinates and new coordinates. And that extra term on this side is just a very fun quantum effect that comes out when you transform trace, when you quantize trace of V squared as a differential operator. So it's a lot of fun. It is this has duality. Quantum mechanical things and classical things are exchanged. So that on this side, you can do completely classical calculations, which know about quantum mechanical stuff on the other side. But anyway, what are the lines? Well, the lines are just Wilson lines. They're defined by saying, okay, I have this connection in 4D, pretty much like connection. I can compute the holonomy along the line. That's my line difference. I insert in the path integral the holonomy along that line. Now, it turns out Wilson lines can end at an upper boundary condition. So suppose I take a fundamental Wilson line, for example. In order for a fundamental Wilson line to end, it needs to end on something which transforms in the fundamental representation of S of 2. And I adjust such a thing. I can put S of Z in there. So, so I get a nice endpoint. And again, I can act from this with derivatives. I can multiply by T and so on. But I have immediately a very nice relation. Second derivative of S plus T of S should be zero. That relation is a very non-trivial quantum statement on this side. It's a very cool property of Hecke operators. And in general, you can get, you know, you can get Wilson lines in any n plus one dimensional representation for SL2 and have them end on the symmetric powers of S. You get you'll get some holomorphic topological factorization algebra with some nice properties. Everything here on this side is classical. And I think it's a rather non-trivial theorem that you could match the quantum results on the A side. These pictures can be refined further. You can think about lines extending in the topological directions too, which become surfaces in the bulk. This might lead you to considerations about local geometric Langlands. I think it would be just cool to sort of encode a lot of material that we know about geometric Langlands in the language of an holomorphic topological factorization algebra living at the boundary of the A and B models. This could be an advanced exercise for the most senior members of the audience. Okay. I have time until 5?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the four-dimensional theory has a whole family of twists besides the A and B twists. I don't know if they will be mentioned at all during the lectures. So I will briefly say something about them. So they are associated to quantum geometric Langlands. Constructions. Are you going to add to the blackboard? Okay. So the more general twists depend on a complex parameter, which I should denote just as kappa. Okay, it's also denoted as psi. But it's really a level. Anyway, this four-dimensional theory has boundary conditions, and all the natural ones are actually topological. So you can have 3D topological boundary conditions. But what happens is that if you consider different choices of these topological boundary conditions, it's often the case that the two-dimensional junctions between them happens to be holomorphic. So in this situation, you get some vertex algebras which are labeled by your gauge group, by the two boundary conditions, and perhaps some extra data. And among these vertex algebras, you find a lot of fun examples, such as Kac-Moody algebras.
These are boundary conditions for the same psi?
Yes. Yeah, psi is... So Kac-Moody algebra at level psi, for example, something that can appear as a vertex algebra, or W algebras, which are obtained as Dreyfus so-called reduction of what is the algebra. And now, this four-dimensional theory has very few things. Doesn't even have lines, although it has surfaces. So you can have lines on individual boundaries, and you can have surfaces that come out and intersect this junction at a point. And all of these can, in principle, give you modules for these vertex algebras. For example, in the Kac-Moody situation, one type of lines give you wild modules. The other type of lines might give you spectral flow images. Or the vacuum. And the intersection with surfaces could give you Verma modules. And, you know, these various types of modules form interesting categories, like this is Kac-Moody, for example, which might or not have nice braiding properties or fusion properties, and so on and so forth. And I believe a lot of those properties can be understood from just this picture. And, you know, the way these various modules interact. And this theory has a psi goes to 1 over psi as duality, leading up to statements in quantum geometric Langlands. And this is all I want to say.
Let's thank Davide.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are there questions? Wait, did you...
No. Sorry. I want to say about this.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
No, for the lecture itself... Oh, what time should I stop for questions?
Five. Yeah.
Five?
Yeah.
Okay. I still have 15 minutes. Yes.
Sorry about the confusion. Sorry.
But are there questions? I know. It's a... Yes. I'm just trying to give an impressionistic overview of a lot of topics and perhaps to begin establishing a little bit of dictionary so that we can talk about these and ask questions that are meaningful. So the Kac-Moody algebra has a spectral flow automorphism. But let me see, what is a good way to say this? Let me first write at the level of the vertex algebra. Let me take SL2 for simplicity. So the spectral flow maps shifts the moding of the operators pretty much by their Cartan charge. Something like that. It's an automorphism that I can discuss more the algebra. I can apply this automorphism to the vacuum module, and I get some other modules. Now, a better perspective is that they have to do with echo modifications. So a correlation function in the presence of a spectral flow operator is like, and coupled to some bundle, is like a correlation function coupled to the Hecke modification of that bundle. So these spectral flow modules really form the category of the modules on the twisted modules on the fine Grassmannian. Mod of GRG or something like that, because so essentially, as I said, if I wanted to compute a correlation function in the presence of a bunch of these insertions and a certain shortness of bundle, I just look at correlation functions without those insertions and at Hecke-modified bundles. Of course, there's a whole space of Hecke modifications. I need to sort of get out a number out of that. And in order to do that, I will integrate all the space of Hecke modifications in some formal sense. And the formal sense is I tensor with some D-module and I take global sections. Right, I'm saying number, I should say vector space, right? If I have a Riemann surface, I'm supposed to get a chiral cohomology. So that was better to say. I'm trying to compute conformal blocks of Kac-Moody in the presence of spectral flow modules as a function, as a D-module on the space of bundles. I do it by taking the conformal blocks at Hecke-modified bundles and somehow convolving with some D-modules in the fine Grassmannian.
Sorry, could I ask a question about the on the vertex algebra side, going from Kac-Moody to W algebra is Drenfeld Sokolov reduction.
Yes.
Does that have like a 4D incarnation in this?
Yes. Although I would love to understand it better.
Right.
There are two different boundary conditions that will give you either Kac-Moody or W algebra. There are Dirichlet boundary conditions or something called Nampol boundary conditions, which are close relatives to these open boundary conditions I described before. Now you can ask, can I do something to say Dirichlet boundary conditions to transform into an open boundary condition? And I can think about different ways of I can think about that in different ways. I could say, okay, I can take the boundary conditions and literally do something to it, meaning I couple new fields to it and I turn on some couplings and hopefully it will become the other boundary condition I'm looking for. That's one possible perspective. The other possible perspective is that there might be a topological junction between Nampol and Dirichlet. Potentially. And I might be able to sort of bring this topological junction on top of the holomorphic junction. This would be like taking some kind of a derived extension. Maybe this might actually not be topological. Maybe it has some degrees of freedom living on there, some ghosts, or something like that. And so I can perhaps think about the Beresti reduction procedure, the so-called reduction, as some kind of a derived extension of the Kac-Moody algebra times some auxiliary things. I'm not sure. So right, so there could be different perspectives on how to realize it.
Thank you.
Yes, there is something else that I find very curious, which are interfaces which have to do with Wakimoto field realizations of the Kac-Moody algebra that I would really love to understand they seem to have something to do with parabolic induction operations, but I don't know it in detail, sufficient detail. Okay. Now, I want to discuss another point which I find interesting. So I might have mentioned before, so in physics, the canonical example of an holomorphic boundary condition is the WCW boundary condition for Chern-Simons theory. So today, Chern-Simons theory is a theory of flat connections. And the WCW boundary condition just tells you, okay, take the anti-holomorphic part of your connection and fix it. So, you know, if you think about flat connections as a bundle with a holomorphic connection, fix the bundle and let the holomorphic connection vary. And then the holomorphic connection itself, after scaling, becomes a current on your boundary, which perturbatively has Kac-Moody OPEs, and then non-perturbative somehow becomes the WCW chiral algebra. And actually, in the physical setup, the fact you get WCW is sort of fixed on you by unitarity, in the sense that the physical theory, the spaces of local operators in the physical theory has some kind of unitarity properties coming from reflection positivity. And those are actually very restrictive. But we don't have anything like that in the twisted world, unfortunately. But what I wanted to say is that when I have Chern-Simons theory at some level K, something which is very natural is to take an holomorphic boundary condition on one side and the anti-holomorphic boundary condition on the other side, kind of forced on you, pretty much. So an anti-holomorphic boundary condition would fix the holomorphic part of the connection and let the anti-holomorphic one vary. It would support anti-holomorphic currents. And this setup is what gives you the actual two-dimensional WCW model. It gives you two-dimensional theory. It's a quantum field theory, full-fledged quantum field theory, which has holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sectors glued together in a topological way. It's a nice CFT. Nice 3D CFT. A useful perspective is that if you just had the holomorphic half or anti-holomorphic half, you get conformal blocks. But there is a nice pairing between the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic conformal blocks, which is modular invariant induction, which is invariant induction mapping class group. So it really defines your correlation function. So there is a partition function associated with the surface, which is a number, not an element of some space or state of conformal blocks. And I think these non-chiral constructions are also natural and useful in the twisted setup. So if I have my 3D A or B models, well, let me take the A model for simplicity. I should be able to take an holomorphic boundary condition in a beta gamma system and anti-holomorphic boundary condition. Even then, and I called this phi before, sorry. Boundary condition. And this will give me a non-chiral, a true two-dimensional theory, which you could call the non-chiral beta gamma system. And now the fundamental question I would like to understand is to which degree I can compute an actual partition function for this, which is modular invariant and combines the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic parts of the for a beta gamma system without gauge theory, this is pretty straightforward in the sense that if I take the partition function of the beta gamma system on some surface, the answer is pretty much something like one over a determinant of the del bar operator in the representation R. And if I want something non-chiral, well, I just get the absolute value. But when you look at, I don't have time to discuss details, but when you look at gauged beta gamma systems, the question is much less trivial. Yes?
To get holomorphic on one and anti-holomorphic on another, you need to deform your A model supercharged in different ways, right?
So... Oh, absolutely. This is not making any sense in the physical theory. You're correct. But in the twisted theory, it does. So in a sense, in the physical theory, this was a 0.4 boundary condition. This is a 4.0 boundary condition. They have no common supercharges, like supersymmetry, which, I mean, it's not the end of the world, really. But in the twisted world, it can be done nicely. And similarly, in the B-twist, I can have a non-chiral WCW model for that funny supergroup. And right, I would like really like to know if these things make sense. And compute them. There is another fun non-chiral setup which is involved in the Fourier theory. Again, you can take holomorphic boundary conditions and anti-holomorphic ones. And now you get a phase space, which is the whole, this, if I take this setup on the Riemann surface sigma, the phase space is just the whole T star of the space of bundles. Really as a real manifold. And so when you quantize this, you get things like L2 normalizable functions on band G. And this is the setup of analytic geometric Langlands. So Hitchin Hamiltonians or Hecke operators and all of that are constructed in the analytic geometric Langland program are constructed by a setup like this. Something holomorphic on one side, and anti-holomorphic on the other. And there are constructions, so you can now put a topological boundary condition here, which is very much like a 3D A or B models, a 3D A model. And you get vertex algebras. And you can build interesting wave functions in this L2 normalizable, L2 or band. Whose properties are controlled by these boundary conditions. And the sort of calculations you need to do to compute these wave functions are precisely these sort of things, these non-chiral beta gamma systems, or these non-chiral WCW models. It's five. So this is definitely a setup that I think is worth looking at. And again, besides the fact that you like to use algebraic geometry, but it should be possible to talk about this in a mathematically rigorous way.
Okay. Let's thank Davide for real this time. Questions?
So one question I had was in this situation where you're gluing a holomorphic beta gamma system in an anti-holomorphic one, if you choose the three-dimensional manifold in between to be something non-trivial, does that give you different ways of gluing the two blocks with one another or the two pieces together?
Yes. In principle, you can put, for example, topological interfaces. This will give you alternative modular invariants, alternative ways to glue together left movers and right movers. That's true. In this setup too, it's kind of a useful thing to do sometimes.
Okay, thanks.
More questions? In person or online?
Can I ask, I'm not sure if this question makes sense, but I'm just trying to sort of think through this 3DA sandwich you have on the board here. Like a lot of the times the theories that we like to think about the 3DA model on is like, we have some sort of stack, like maybe we have the cotangent bundle of like C to the N mod a torus. And then there's some, inside of that, like, we have an actual quiver variety or whatever, which is determined by some real Kähler parameter, which I treat as like a stability condition, the throwaway, some unstable subset. And oftentimes it seems like maybe, that whatever we were considering before didn't really care very much about what that parameter was. I mean, it cares about it in some kind of, topological way or something, but it is the contention that like in this setup you have on the board, now that real parameter is actually going to be, things are going to be more sensitive to that real parameter?
I hope not.
Oh, no. Okay.
I hope not.
But there's some like more real parameters that you're supposed to be turning on here, right? Or that it's, the resulting thing is kind of supposed to be sensitive to things that the 3DA model itself is not sensitive to.
Well, but there are parameters that live on the boundaries.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Okay,
for example, this will be a function on this moduli space of Riemann surfaces.
Yes.
A function which is not holomorphic or anti-holomorphic. Although perhaps it can be written as a sum of products of holomorphic and allomorphic things.
I'm just trying to figure out like what kinds of parameters that function might depend on.
Yeah, it should depend on the complex structures on the two sides. If the theory has symmetries, it would depend also on a bundle, or in the A case, or on a flat connection, the B case.
Okay, thanks.
I can give you an example. So suppose I take just the star C in the middle. So here I have just the beta gamma system or symplectic boson, beta bar gamma bar. So I could couple this to an AU1 bundle or even to an SL2 bundle. That should be a bit better, because this theory actually is an SL2 global symmetry. And if I, the answer then will be just literally 1/ the absolute value of the determinant of the del bar operator on the bundle tensored with K^(1/2). This is an example of the answer. This is a nice function on the space of bundles. It has a regular singularity at the theta divisor, where you get zero modes for the beta gamma system. If you had a gauge theory, then you might get something like this and perhaps integrate it over the space of bundles. With natural measure. There are some anomaly cancellation conditions, and if they're satisfied, this is actually density. You can integrate it. And so now I need to make sense of this integral in the space of bundles. Does it converge? Does it make sense? I've done it only in one single example, and it worked. And gave me something modular invariant, but that's not, doesn't, which was the case of SU2, SL2, acting on C16 as sort of C, on C2 to the eight copies of, four copies of C2. Eight copies of C2. Anyway. Because then, and I did not do a calculation on a general Riemann surface that would kill me. You can do calculations on a sphere if you introduce certain modules. And then I did a calculation and it seemed to be giving a sensible answer. And the sensible answer is sort of the sum of two terms, each of which is an absolute value squared of something. Pretty much. Because in that case, I think the theory has two conformal blocks. But I don't know the general theory.
Further questions? Zoom?
If I understand correctly, in for the A twist, you mentioned about the local operators or line defects is a kind of hack operators. Does this Kyle algebra related to the Kyle hack algebra constructed by Benz and Grünfeld?
I believe so.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. But I mean, if you take this setup and you just read the paper by on analytic geometric Langlands, you can follow the physical meaning of most of the constructions there. So, you know, once you have a toothed operator stretched between two boundaries, this literally gives you Hecke operators acting on this space and so on and so forth.
Thank you.
All right, let's thank Davide again.